8. Whatever their contradictions, Americans were consistent, before and after their first revolution, in deeply distrusting government. Having been left on their own for so long, the colonists saw as sinister any British action affecting them. The most minor incidents, the historian Gordon Wood has shown, erupted into major constitutional questions involving the basic liberties of the people. Allergies that extreme don't easily disappear, and this one lasted long after Great Britain accepted the independence of the United States in 1783. The Americans simply turned it upon themselves. Perhaps victory made forbearance less necessary. Perhaps it exposed an issue they'd so far evaded. Had the revolution secured equality of opportunity, the right to rise to inequality, or of condition, the obligation not to? Perhaps corruptions in British society had now, like smallpox, infected its American counterpart. Perhaps legislation, if unchecked, always produced tyranny, whether in parliaments or confederations. Perhaps the people themselves weren't to be trusted. Perhaps the British had been right, some Americans thought but couldn't say, in having tried to replace neglect with a heavier hand. By outward appearances, the country was flourishing. Despite the war, population was growing as fast as Franklin had predicted it would. Peace more than doubled the space available for settlement. Prosperity was widespread. "If we are undone," one South Carolinian wrote at the time, "we are the most splendidly ruined of any nation in the universe." But because expectations were high and the world hadn't begun again, fears gnawed away at self-confidence. Nothing worried the Americans more than the prospect that, having humiliated Great Britain, they wouldn't be taken seriously themselves as a great power. If their revolution had established only a League of Nations, if authority was shared to the point that it had no center, then how could the new country impress any older one that did? "No treaty can be made with the American states that can be binding on the whole," Lord Sheffield, Gibbon's editor for The Decline and Fall, complained in 1784. "We might as reasonably dread the effects of combinations among the German as among the American states, and deprecate the resolves of the Diet as those of Congress." An island had shown that it couldn't rule a continent. Could a republic? There'd been none on that scale since Rome's. Not a happy precedent. The break with Britain had come over taxation without representation, which was hardly possible across a great ocean. But what about an ocean of land? "We have passed the Rubicon," a pamphleteer pointed out, and the question now is whether we shall break up into separate disproportioned clans and hordes, each under petty captains and rulers, who will be as tyrannical as they dare to be, and will keep the whole continent in a constant state of turbulence, or whether we will all unite, or the great majority of us, in establishing a general and efficient government, which shall include the whole territory ceded to the United States by the Treaty of Paris in 1783. It was almost as if the British, by granting such boundaries, had planted a time bomb. Could a republic become an empire without, as Gibbon seemed to be showing Rome to have done, replacing its liberties with tyrannies? 9. The second American Revolution began, in the manner of Augustus, with a pyramid scheme of purposefully inconclusive meetings. The first took place at Washington's Mount Vernon in 1785. Ostensibly to stop the bickering between Maryland and Virginia over navigation rights on the Potomac. The real issue, the participants concluded, was internal tariffs, and that required a larger conference at Annapolis in 1786. But those present saw the need for still larger adjustments in the Articles, for which they organized a constitutional convention in Philadelphia in 1787. It, in turn, in closed sessions, swept the Articles into oblivion. It wasn't a coup d'etat, It moved too slowly and politely for that. As a fait accompli, however, it came close. The Augustus was Washington, whose reflexive restraint in seeking power, his most recent biographer has suggested, enabled him to exercise so much of it. He hosted the 1785 meeting while committing himself to nothing. He allowed two young Agrippas, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, to lead in public, while making it clear privately where he stood. What stronger evidence can be given of the want of energy in our governments than these disorders? The great man fumed, sounding a little like George III, when Massachusetts farmers marched on their tax-hungry state government late in 1786. And, in 1787, Washington let himself be persuaded, although not easily, to chair the Philadelphia Convention. Once there, he said hardly a word. He didn't have to. August presences achieve their purposes, he knew, simply by showing up. Over the following summer, the delegates crafted the world's longest living but least amended constitution, with which few of its signatories were fully satisfied, which led the Agrippas, with some help from John Jay, to rush into print, as the Federalist, a justification for ratification 34 times the length of the document it defended. Addressed to the people of the state of New York, its 85 essays, all signed Publius, didn't determine the outcome. They got little circulation beyond New York, and when that state did finally ratify, in July 1788, 10 others, more than enough, had already done so. The Federalists' fame rests elsewhere, as the most enduring work of political grand strategy since Machiavelli's The Prince. The Constitution and the Federalist share the qualities of having been pressed by time in composition, but liberated from time in lasting significance. The paradox gets at the heart of what it means to hold opposing ideas in the mind simultaneously, while retaining the ability, here brilliantly, to function. Wherein, then, did the brilliance lie? 10. It's not enough to chalk it up to Dr. Samuel Johnson's, "Depend upon it, sir, when a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully." Many men have gone to the gallows with scattered minds, and the American founders, despite Dr. Franklin's fondness for gallows humor, were long past literal fears of such a fate. What they did face, as a weak new power in an arena of stronger older ones, as a society unsure of where within itself sovereignty should reside, as idealists disillusioned by human nature, as realists who thought they might reform human nature, as students of history obliged now to make their own, was the need to align incompatible aspirations with limited capabilities. The Federalist was meant to do that. "The subject speaks its own importance," Hamilton announced in the first essay's first paragraph, "comprehending in its consequences nothing less than the existence of the Union, the safety and welfare of the parts of which it is composed, the fate of an empire in many respects the most interesting in the world." For it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country, by their conduct and example, to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. Settling so great an issue would require a judicious estimate of our true interests, unperplexed and unbiased by considerations not connected with the public good. But, chillingly, this is a thing more ardently to be wished than seriously to be expected. The plan offered to our deliberations affects too many particular interests, innovates upon too many local institutions, not to involve in its discussion a variety of objects foreign to its merits and of views, passions, and prejudices little favorable to the discovery of truth. the world, watching, would never forget. The Americans, acting, were inattentive. Means mustered were falling far short of ends envisaged. A crisis was now at hand. The Federalist was an ambivalent clarion call. For how could submergence within a union not drown its parts? Had any empire ever functioned without accidents of inheritance and legitimation through force? Could parochial concerns collectively coalesce? Of what use was a judicious estimate if more ardently to be wished than seriously to be expected? Wise men were so often wrong, Hamilton acknowledged, that they might teach moderation to those who are ever so much persuaded of their being in the right. That made it foolish to insist on consistency. One must remake logic itself. That's why Hamilton began, as had Augustus, by disarming resistance with humility. 11. Which somehow made it appropriate that the Federalists' hardest task, showing how a republic could be an empire without becoming a tyranny, fell to Madison, the most easily underestimated of the American founders. He fulfilled it triumphantly by connecting time, space, and scale. History had shown instability, injustice, and confusion always to have extinguished popular governments, Madison wrote in the 10th Publius essay. Independence had yet to free Americans from these dangers. Complaints are everywhere heard that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. Revoking liberty would be a remedy worse than the disease, but curing it through equality would leave no one safe. Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. The causes of faction were too human to be removed. Relief could perhaps come, however, from controlling its effects. Distance had so far kept republics small, because the representation upon which they depended required the cooling of passions that only deliberative assemblies, meeting regularly, could provide. They couldn't perform that function when territories were widely dispersed. The American Republic now extended across a third of a continent, and was unlikely to stop there. How, then, could the British time bomb of generosity, the ocean of land ceded in 1783, failed to revive familiar protests of no taxation without representation? Where, if that happened, would Hamilton's union be? Madison solved these issues of time and space by shifting scale. In doing so, he drew, knowingly or not, on Machiavelli. For only in republics, the Florentine had observed, could the common good be looked to properly. By expanding the number who benefited, the influence of the few who didn't could be reduced. Not all parts, submerged in holes, need drown. Scale could be the life preserver. There were, Madison acknowledged, dangers in this. By enlarging too much the number of electors, voters, you render the representative too little acquainted with all their local circumstances and lesser interests, as by reducing it too much, you render him unduly attached to these, and too little fit to comprehend and pursue great and national objects. But surely there existed a mean on both sides of which inconveniences will be found to lie. In this way, balancing factions, a Burkean enterprise, could put inconveniences to good use. Extend the sphere, and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests. You make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens, or if such a common motive exists, it will be more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and to act in unison with each other. The proposed Constitution forms a happy combination in this respect, the great and aggregate interests being referred to the national, the local and particular to the state legislatures. Madison thus deployed scale across space to reverse time. History would henceforth strengthen his republic by allowing factions to compete at all levels, so that as the country grew, its path would not be that of Rome. The Federalists' arc bent toward a Lincoln, not a Nero. 12. If that's the case, though, why did the Union under Lincoln so catastrophically fail? The easy answer might be that no strategy anticipates all contingencies, that every solution creates new problems, and that these can, at times, overwhelm. The harsher one, although I think the more accurate one, lies in the possibility that the founders left the Union to test itself, knowing the need to proportion aspirations to capabilities, recognizing the incompatibilities in good things. They chose to save their new state and leave to their descendants the saving of its soul. Augustine and Machiavelli had both seen in proportionality a way to balance the respective claims of souls and states. Their differences lay in whether equilibria reached required accountability to God. Augustine said yes, and labored mightily to provide it. Machiavelli's God left statecraft to man. Americans, in varieties almost as infinite as those of Elizabeth I, straddled this divide. They could be, like their early leaders, coolly pragmatic, like their revivalists, fiercely religious, and like their entrepreneurs, anywhere in between. What's clear, though, is that few in the young republic questioned, at least not openly, what so many in the mature republic would give their lives to change. The anomaly that a constitution promising a more perfect union assumed slavery's legality. It acknowledged, in doing so, what the Declaration of Independence couldn't say, that all men were not created equal. The men of 1776 feared, Jefferson not least among them, that if they freed the slaves along with the country, they'd have no state. The Constitution put the anxiety into legalese by apportioning places in the House of Representatives to the whole number of free persons and to 3/5 of all other persons by prohibiting for 20 years any restrictions on the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, and by requiring that no person held to service or labor in one state, escaping into another, shall be discharged from such service or labor. The word slavery was nowhere mentioned. The evasion left Madison, in the Federalist, grasping for straws. "It were doubtless to be wished," he wrote feebly, "that the power of prohibiting the importation of slaves had not been postponed until the year 1808, or rather that it had been suffered to have immediate operation. But that passage of time may terminate forever within these states a traffic which has so long and so loudly upbraided the barbarism of modern policy. Happy would it be for the unfortunate Africans if an equal prospect lay before them of being redeemed from the oppressions of their European brethren." Unhappily hypocritical, though, for Madison, who elsewhere defended the 3/5 clause in a long, labored passage that purported to represent the views of American brethren who saw slaves as both people and property. Such is the reasoning which an advocate for the Southern interests might employ on this subject. And although it may appear to be a little strained in some points, yet, on the whole, I must confess that it fully reconciles me to the scale of representation which the Constitutional Convention have established. Madison's balancing required a barbarity, so it's no surprise that he found himself straining. The options he faced, however, were irreconcilable. The founders could have union or emancipation, but not both, at least not in their generation. And so they chose union now, postponing emancipation on the assumption, infrequently expressed, that the prospects for it would be better in a single strong state than in several weaker ones. It was a wager, whether with God or the devil, depended on your point of view. 13. The founders put the reckoning beyond their lifetimes by seeking a Republican continental empire. Hamilton, the firmest among them in opposing slavery, nonetheless saw in an expanding union the opportunity to become the arbiter of Europe in America, and to be able to incline the balance of European competitions in this part of the world as our interest may dictate. Madison showed how, by balancing internal interests, external expansion could occur. Jefferson, after becoming president, balanced his near-pathological hatred of Hamilton against the windfall of acquiring Louisiana from the French at a bargain price, thereby again doubling the Union's extent. To lose our country by a scrupulous adherence to written laws, he later rationalized, Hamilton, whether from heaven or hell, must have smiled, if thinly, would be to lose the law itself, thus absurdly sacrificing the end to the means. And in 1811, John Quincy Adams, then 44, took it upon himself to inform his mother that the choice lay between having, on the one hand, an endless multitude of little insignificant clans and tribes at eternal war with one another for a rock or a fish pond, the sport and fable of European masters and oppressors, and, on the other, a nation, coextensive with the North American continent, destined by God and nature to be the most populous and most powerful people ever combined under one social compact. Thus, circling back to his father's 1776 anticipation of fireworks from sea to sea. The younger Adam set off more than his share, mostly at Spain's expense, after becoming James Monroe's Secretary of State in 1817. Philip II's empire still sprawled on maps from mid-North America to the Strait of Magellan, but the French Revolution and the rise of Napoleon had infected it with independence, as had the example of the United States. Adams, like a shark, exploited the infirmity. He began with Florida, where he turned a preemptive military attack, launched under questionable authority by Andrew Jackson, into an ultimatum. Spain must secure that territory's borders, or cede to the United States a province which is in fact a derelict, open to the occupancy of every enemy, civilized or savage, of the United States, and serving no other earthly purpose than as a post of annoyance to them. By 1821, the Spanish had relinquished Florida in return for an American assumption of American claims there, an exclusion of Texas, soon to be Mexican anyway, from the United States, and an agreement to make their empire's remaining northern border the 42nd parallel, a line drawn all the way to the Pacific, despite the Americans having no clear title to anything on its other side. It was a brash display of audacity in statecraft, unmatched until Adams himself, 2 years later, exceeded it. The occasion was Monroe's annual message to Congress, to be delivered in December 1823. The opportunity arose in a quiet offer from the British Foreign Secretary, George Canning, to work with the United States to prevent Russia, Prussia, Austria, and post-Napoleonic France from any effort to restore Spanish rule, now almost lost, in the New World. Canning had in mind British commercial interests, which the British Navy needed no help in securing. Bringing in the Americans might, however, smooth over bitterness still left from the War of 1812 and the British burning of Washington 2 years later. But Adams saw the chance, through a clever tweak, of a revolutionary pronouncement. hence the great doctrine for which Monroe is principally remembered, that the American continents, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintain, are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. An empty gesture? Given capabilities at the time, certainly, but not in the light of the aspirations Hamilton had invoked in the Federalist, to deploy the natural strength and resources of the country in the common interest of baffling all the combinations of European jealousy to restrain our growth. In short, to become the arbiter of Europe in America. There could be no such interest, however, had Madison not shown, in the Federalist, how first to restrain American jealousies. That was the purpose of the uneasy Missouri Compromise of 1820, which equally apportioned new territories as future free or slave states. Adams went along, convinced that the Constitution's bargain between freedom and slavery was morally and politically vicious, inconsistent with the principles upon which alone our revolution can be justified, but also knowing that the bargain was keeping the Union from civil war, the result of which would surely be the extirpation of slavery from this whole continent, and, calamitous and desolating as this course of events and its progress must be, so glorious would be its final issue that, as God shall judge me, I dare not say that it is not to be desired. But, as the young Augustine might have said, not now. Conversion, emancipation, and God himself would have to wait. 14. How, then, did a young republic, in what still was an age of empires, get away with proclaiming hegemony over a hemisphere? Perhaps the British, like weary parents, had learned to indulge the antics of children. The principle, if principle it may be called, Canning condescended early in 1824, was new to this government. But within 3 years, that particular parent was boasting to the House of Commons that, "I called the New World into existence to redress the balance of the old." Having pulled out the plum and claimed credit for the pudding, a furious American historian later complained Canning had outdone even little Jack Horner. What a big boy am I! Canning, however, had more in mind than that. Convinced that North America was not about to break up into clans and tribes quibbling over fish ponds, he looked ahead to what the implications might be. Not yet visible among them was Winston Churchill, born to an American mother in Blenheim Palace in 1874. The greatest Englishman since the Great Queen was not one to neglect power balances or good quotations. He recycled Canning's frequently, most memorably in his speech to the House of Commons on the British evacuation from Dunkirk on June 4, 1940. He would never surrender, Churchill vowed, but if this island, or a large part of it, were subjugated and starving, then our empire, beyond the oceans, armed and guarded by the British fleet, will carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the New World, with all its power and might, sets forth to the rescue and liberation of the old. Both Canning and Churchill sensed a shift in history's tectonics. The foreign minister from afar, the prime minister from beneath his feet, comparable in importance to the one set in motion by the change in the winds a few miles down the coast from Dunkirk on an evening in August 1588. Which raises a question. Why, in the 18th and 19th centuries, did only one New World state build sufficient power to restore balances in the old, not once but three times, in the 20th. How could such strength have emerged from the fractiously disorganized British colonies and not from their larger, richer, and more carefully run Spanish counterparts to the south? Simón Bolívar, their liberator, suggested an answer as early as 1815. There would never be, he acknowledged, a United States of Latin America. One reason was geography. It might be easier to rule an empire from its seaports than from its interior, but this didn't prepare a nation to rule itself. The internal barriers of climate, topography, habitats, cultures, and communications were too great. Who is capable even of compiling complete statistics of a land like this? Bolivar complained. The Isthmus of Panama was far from being, for us, what the Isthmus of Corinth was for the Greeks. Why, though, couldn't variety have become strength, as Madison made it in Federalist No. 10? The problem here, Bolivar argued, was political immaturity. Spain had so tightly controlled its territories as to keep them in a permanent infancy, unable to command self-respect. We have even been deprived of an active tyranny, since we have not been permitted to exercise its functions. Once the world's greatest empire, Spain was now too weak to prevail, but had trained no one to take its place. Representative governments, hence, would find it difficult to take root. Some form of absolutism, probably disguised as republicanism, was more likely. But not, Bolivar thought, on a continental scale. For authoritarians, by their nature, resist cooperation. Only under the guidance and protection of a great liberal nation could the Latin Americans cultivate the virtues and talents that lead to glory. That inspired Adams's contemporary, Henry Clay, who ardently advocated United States support not only for Latin American independence movements, but also those of the Greeks, then rebelling against Ottoman rule. Adams himself, though, understood how quickly such help could overstretch resources, material and moral. America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy, he admonished the House of Representatives in a speech of his own on July 4, 1821. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. There, unforgettably, was the compromise characteristic of the age. Freedom in principle, perhaps even partially, eventually, in practice. But union and its requirement that great ends be kept within available means came first. Only a state at peace with itself could save its soul. For now. Chapter 7. The Grandest Strategists. There's a curious moment just prior to Leo Tolstoy's account of the Battle of Borodino, page 774 in the Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokhonsky translation of War and Peace, when two of its central characters, Pierre Bezukhov and Prince Andrei Bolkonsky, step out of a shed, look up, and see Karl von Clausewitz with another officer riding by. One is saying, "War must be extended in space. I cannot put too high a price on this view." The other agrees. The aim is to weaken the enemy, so one cannot pay attention to the loss of private persons. This disgusts André, across whose estate this war already has been extended. "All there is in a German head," he complains bitterly to Pierre, "is reasoning, which isn't worth a tinker's dam. They gave him, Napoleon, the whole of Europe, and came to teach us. Fine teachers." Within the short distance separating the view on horseback from that on the ground, Tolstoy evokes the gap that exists, at all levels, between theory and practice. It's one of many instances in which his micro-insights have macro-implications. But Clausewitz's writings are full of them, too. Few, if any others, have thought more deeply or written more perceptively about time, space, and scale than the horseman who passes and the novelist who portrayed him. Pierre and André were at Borodino, of course, only in Tolstoy's imagination. But Clausewitz really was there. When the French invaded in 1812, he resigned his commission in the Prussian army, joined the Russians, and fought in the Great Battle. The meticulous Tolstoy would have known this, and could have read On War, published posthumously in 1832, before writing War and Peace in the 1860s. His Clausewitz prefers abstraction to observation, a charge many critics repeated well into the 20th century. It's possible, though, that Tolstoy wasn't reproaching Clausewitz, but rather reflecting what Russians thought at the time of their new Prussian allies. For not only do Tolstoy and Clausewitz see the practice of war similarly, they also construct theories drawn from their own military experiences about the limitations of theory itself. 1. Let us accompany a novice to the battlefield, Clausewitz writes in On War, leaving not the slightest doubt that he knows his subject. As we approach, the rumble of guns grows louder and alternates with the whir of cannonballs, which begin to attract his attention. Shots begin to strike close around us. We hurry up the slope where the commanding general is stationed with his large staff. Here, cannonballs and bursting shells are frequent, and life begins to seem more serious than the young man had imagined. Suddenly, someone you know is wounded. Then a shell falls among the staff. You notice that some of the officers act a little oddly. You yourself are not as steady and collected as you were. Even the bravest can become slightly distracted. Now we enter the battle raging before us, still almost like a spectacle, and join the nearest division commander. Shot is falling like hail, and the thunder of our own guns adds to the din. Forward to the brigadier, a soldier of acknowledged bravery, but he is careful to take cover behind a rise, a house, or a clump of trees. A noise is heard that is a certain indication of increasing danger, the rattling of grape shot on roofs and on the ground. Cannonballs tear past, whizzing in all directions, and musket balls begin to whistle around us. A little further, we reach the firing line, where the infantry endures the hammering for hours with incredible steadfastness. The air is filled with hissing bullets that sound like a sharp crack if they pass close to one's head. For a final shock, the sight of men being killed and mutilated moves our pounding hearts to awe and pity. The novice cannot pass through these layers of increasing intensity of danger without sensing that here ideas are governed by other factors, that the light of reason is refracted in a manner quite different from that which is normal in academic speculation. Now, here's Tolstoy, who'd served with the Russian army in the Caucasus, the Balkans, and the Crimean War during the 1850s, on Borodino. From the battlefield, the adjutants he had sent and his marshal's orderlies constantly came galloping to Napoleon with reports on the course of events. But all these reports were false, both because in the heat of battle it is impossible to tell what is going on at a given moment, and because many of the adjutants did not reach the actual place of battle, but told what they had heard from others. And also, because while an adjutant was riding the mile or so that separated him from Napoleon, the circumstances changed, and the news he was bringing became incorrect. On the weight of such unavoidably false reports, Napoleon gave his instructions, which either had been carried out before he ever gave them, or were not and could not be carried out. The marshals and the generals who were closer to the battlefield, but who, like Napoleon, did not take part in the battle itself, but only occasionally rode into the fire, gave their own instructions and orders about where to shoot and from where, and where the cavalry were to ride and the infantry to run without asking Napoleon. But even their instructions were carried out as rarely and to as small a degree as Napoleon's instructions. For the most part, what came out was the opposite of what they had ordered. Soldiers who were told to advance would come under canister shot and run back. Soldiers who were told to stay where they were, suddenly seeing the Russians appear unexpectedly before them, sometimes ran back and sometimes rushed forward, and the cavalry galloped without orders in pursuit of the fleeing Russians. As soon as these men left that space through which the cannonballs and bullets flew, their commanders, who stood in the rear, formed them up, established discipline, and, under the effect of that discipline, again led them into the zone of fire, in which, under the effect of the fear of death, they again lost discipline and rushed about according to the chance mood of the crowd. These passages are as far from abstraction as it's possible to imagine. Indeed, you might wonder, from reading them, what the chaos of battle can ever accomplish. And yet Borodino, despite having had no clear winner, accomplished a lot. The battle weakened both sides, but the Russians had more territory even than the Americans into which to retreat, abandoning Moscow as they did so. The French, far from home, advanced farther when Napoleon couldn't resist taking the city, hoping to shock Tsar Alexander I into making peace. When that didn't happen, the greatest military genius since Julius Caesar assumed the attributes of a dog who'd chased a car and caught it. What do you do next? Meanwhile, as his humblest private could have reminded him, winter was coming on. Clausewitz called this the culminating point of Napoleon's offensive, by which he meant that the French had defeated themselves by exhausting themselves. Flashing the sword of vengeance, the Russians could now drive them from the country. Tolstoy's old, fat, slow-moving commanding general, Mikhail Kutuzov, makes the point better than Clausewitz did. Few figures in history have done more by appearing to do less. Napoleon, as a consequence, lost his army, and within a year and a half, his throne. The Russian Tsar triumphantly toured Paris, was received in London respectfully, and even dined at Oxford in the Radcliffe Camera while the dons gawked at him, enthralled, from the balconies. War's grammar, Clausewitz writes in On War, may be its own, but not its logic. With training, discipline, and superior leadership, armies can suspend temporarily the all-too-human instinct to flee from danger. Combat, as Clausewitz's novice discovers, defies common sense. In time, though, logic surrounds, confounds, and supersedes such grammar. Heroics drain you. Offensives slow as supply lines lengthen. Retreats invite counterattack. Russia is big, and its winters are cold. Dogs that catch cars never know what to do with them. Why, then, did Napoleon forget what most fools remember? Perhaps because common sense is indeed like oxygen. The higher you go, the thinner it gets. As each triumph topped its antecedent, Napoleon's grammar became his logic. Like Caesar, he rose so far above fundamentals as to lose sight of them altogether. Such a sense can be awe-inspiring. So, too, in their day, were hot air balloons. But gravity is always present. 2. Clausewitz died in 1831 before finishing On War, leaving us with a huge, unwieldy, and contradictory book, a close reading of which, I warn my students, risks mental disorientation. You can wind up unsure of what he said, and with doubts even about who you are. Tolstoy did finish War and Peace in 1868, but with little clearer sense of what he'd accomplished. It is not a novel, still less an epic poem, still less a historical chronicle. War and peace is what the author wanted and was able to express, in the form in which it is expressed. Isaiah Berlin detects in Tolstoy's evasiveness a tormenting inner conflict, like the results of too carefully reading Clausewitz, between the delusive experience of free will and the reality of inexorable historical determinism. But what if Clausewitz and Tolstoy were wrestling with contradictions, perhaps even relishing the contest, rather than agonizing over them? Both see determinism as laws to which there can be no exceptions. If even one man out of millions in a 1,000-year period of time has had the possibility of acting freely, Tolstoy writes, then it is obvious that one free act of this man, contrary to the laws, destroys the possibility of the existence of any laws whatever for the whole of mankind. Clausewitz agrees, with the qualification that if laws can't contain the diversity of the real world, then the application of principle allows for a greater latitude of judgment. The proverb speaks of an exception to every rule, not to every law, suggesting that as abstractions approach reality, they permit a more liberal interpretation. That would be consistent with Tolstoy, who seeks at such length to subvert all laws. Too many theories, Clausewitz complains, try too hard to be laws. He cites, as an example, this Prussian fire-extinguishing regulation. If a house is on fire, one must above all seek to save the right wall of the house on the left, and on the other hand, the left wall of the house on the right. For if, for example, one were to try and protect the left wall of the house on the left, one must remember that the right wall of the house is on the right of its left wall. And thus, since the fire is also to the right of this wall and of the right wall, for we have assumed that the house is on the left of the fire, the right wall is closer to the fire than the left, and the right wall of the house could burn down if it were not protected before the fire would reach the left protected wall. Consequently, something could burn down that was not protected, and sooner than something else, even if this something else was also unprotected. Consequently, the latter must be left alone, and the former must be protected. To fix the point firmly in mind, one need only remember, if the house is to the right of the fire, it is the left wall that matters, and if the house is on the left, it is the right wall. On War, Clausewitz promises, will avoid such nonsense, instead presenting ideas and convictions gained from years of thinking about war, much association with able men who knew war, and a good deal of personal experience with it. These he'll convey in compressed form like small nuggets of pure metal. Which sounds like Machiavelli, whose work Clausewitz knew and admired. But the cholera that killed him at 51 denied him the time he'd have needed to shorten On War and to make it clear. So it's not so much nuggets as an immense dripping net of entangled octopi. It therefore benefits, as does Augustine's City of God, from flyover reading. You can't allow yourself to get stranded in what Sir Michael Howard has called Clausewitz's infuriating incoherence. It's harder to fly through War and Peace. Tolstoy's too captivating a writer. But even he, toward the end, taxes his readers with long, rambling digressions on the ineffectiveness of great men and the pointlessness of history. It helps to let his river of words carry you past these pontifications, and only later revisit them. You'll find Clausewitz reflected and in some ways improved upon. Here, for instance, is Tolstoy's theory of recent European history. Louis XIV was a very proud and presumptuous man. He had such and such mistresses and such ministers, and he ruled France badly. Louis's heirs were also weak men, and also ruled France badly. They, too, had such and such favorites and such mistresses. Besides, certain men were writing books at the time. At the end of the 18th century, some 2 dozen men got together in Paris and started talking about all men being equal and free. That led people all over France to start slaughtering and drowning each other. These people killed the king and many others. At the same time, there was in France a man of genius, Napoleon. He defeated everybody everywhere. That is, he killed a lot of people, because he was a great genius. And he went off for some reason to kill Africans, and he killed them so well, and was so cunning and clever, that, on coming back to France, he ordered everybody to obey him. And everybody obeyed him. Having become emperor, he again went to kill people in Italy, Austria, and Prussia. And there he killed a lot. In Russia, there was the Emperor Alexander, who decided to restore order in Europe and therefore made war with Napoleon. But in the year 7, he suddenly made friends with him. Then in the year 11, quarreled again, and again they started killing a lot of people. And Napoleon brought 600,000 men to Russia and captured Moscow. Then he suddenly ran away from Moscow, and then the Emperor Alexander united Europe to take up arms against the disturber of its peace. All Napoleon's allies suddenly became his enemies, and this armed force marched against Napoleon, who had gathered new forces. The allies defeated Napoleon, entered Paris, made Napoleon abdicate, and exiled him to the island of Elba, not depriving him of the dignity of emperor and showing him every respect, though 5 years earlier and 1 year later, everybody considered him a bandit and an outlaw. And so began the reign of Louis the 18th, whom, until then, both the French and the Allies had only laughed at. Then skillful statesmen and diplomats talked in Vienna, and with these talks made people happy or unhappy. Suddenly the diplomats and monarchs nearly quarreled. They were already prepared to order their troops to kill each other again, but at that moment Napoleon arrived in France with a battalion, and the French, who hated him, all submitted to him at once. But the Allied monarchs were angered by that, and again went to war with the French. And the genius Napoleon was defeated and taken to the island of St. Helena, having suddenly been recognized as a bandit. And there the exile, separated from those dear to his heart and from his beloved France, died a slow death on the rock and bequeathed his great deeds to posterity. But in Europe there was reaction, and the sovereigns all started mistreating their own people again. We don't normally think of Tolstoy or Clausewitz as laugh riots, but the fact that both could ridicule theories suggests respect for irregularities, not a compulsion to cover them up. What really obsessed them, I think, was irony, which my dictionary defines as an outcome of events contrary to what was or might have been expected. No European could have lived unastonished through or beyond the age of Napoleon. Astonishments haunted Clausewitz and Tolstoy, as did the conviction that they'd arisen from collisions between a universal law, that although ends can be infinite, means can never be, and a recurring human peculiarity. That for characters like Napoleon, Hellespont's are there to be crossed. 3. Napoleon had crossed so many by June 24, 1812, that the River Niemen, then the boundary between the Russian Empire and the French-controlled Duchy of Warsaw, didn't much worry him. His Grande Armée had over 600,000 men, and, surpassing Xerxes, 3 pontoon bridges. It still took 5 days to get everyone across, but when they returned in December, only 90,000 were left. This rate of attrition couldn't help but revive a question asked of the Persians in Greece, the Athenians in Sicily, the Romans in the Teutoburg Forest, the Spanish in the English Channel, and the British in America. What were they thinking? Or, to put it another way, what had Napoleon forgotten? Clausewitz answers this question with acute insights that, like Augustine's on just war, require recovery from where he's hidden them. The opening page of On War, for example, could be Patton's harangue to his troops in the eponymous movie's opening scene. War is an active force to compel our enemy to do our will. Attached to force are certain self-imposed, imperceptible limitations hardly worth mentioning, known as international law and custom, but they scarcely weaken it. Force, that is physical force, for moral force has no existence save as expressed in the state and the law, is thus the means of war. To impose our will on the enemy is its object. But then you get this qualification. That, in theory, is the true aim of warfare. So what should its practice be? The maximum use of force is in no way incompatible with the simultaneous use of the intellect, Clausewitz assures us. For if civilized nations do not put their prisoners to death or devastate cities and countries, it is because intelligence plays a larger part in their methods of warfare and has taught them more effective ways of using force than the crude expression of instinct. Our heads are spinning now, and we're only 2 pages into a very big book. Whatever else you might say about Patton, he was at least clear in telling his troops what to think. Clausewitz, however, is trying to teach us how to think. You can't know anything, he's sure, without first grasping its purest form. The idea is Plato's, but its most influential recent advocate was Clausewitz's near contemporary, Immanuel Kant, who sought to reconcile opposites by first starkly posing them. Gradations, qualifications, and mitigations could then follow. Or, as Clausewitz himself explained, where two ideas form a true logical antithesis, then fundamentally, each is implied in the other. If the limitations of our mind do not allow us to comprehend both simultaneously, and discover by antithesis the whole of one in the whole of the other, each will nevertheless shed enough light on the other to clarify many of its details. The method isn't for the literal-minded, whom it will confuse, or for the faint-hearted, who will find it shocking. If Clausewitz's purpose is, however, like Virgil's in Dante, to guide us through an inferno, then it's grimly appropriate. 4. For war, in Clausewitz's time, had become an inferno, approaching what civilized nations were no longer supposed to do. The campaigns of the French Revolution and Napoleon killed millions of people, ruined vast territories, and snuffed out sovereignties throughout Europe. Technology alone can't explain these upheavals, for as Michael Howard has pointed out, arms hadn't improved for 100 years, and transport for over 1,000. But politics had turned upside down, and this in turn inflamed war. The Americans, unintentionally, set the process in motion. They'd welcomed Louis XVI's assistance in their war for independence, a Machiavellian calculation on his part and theirs, but rewarded him with un-Machiavellian claims about universal rights of man, which they took less literally than did the king's combustible subjects. As a consequence, Louis lost his head, and the French lost all restraint. But through their revolution in politics, they acquired mass armies, the terrible instrument, Howard writes, with which Napoleon, the emperor who acquired France, conquered Europe. Which led Clausewitz to his first and most urgent finding, that if war, in this sense, reflects politics, it must be subordinate to politics, and therefore to policy, the product of politics. Otherwise, it's senseless violence, a Kantian abstraction that shouldn't exist, but which, Clausewitz feared, now was nearer. War required redefinition, therefore, as a true political instrument, a continuation of political intercourse, carried on with other means. The political object is the goal. War is the means of reaching it, and means can